Thank you very much for the welcome. It's great to be here in the city of Weimar. I find this a very wonderful place to be. One of the things that surprised me was the list of people who've stayed in the same hotel that I'm staying at just down the road. I see one of those people was Tolstoy, attracted to this place many years ago, obviously. Now, you may ask, what's the link between Tolstoy and South Africa? Well, there is a link. Tolstoy's writings strongly influenced the philosophy of passive resistance developed by Mahatma Gandhi, which in turn inspired great leaders like Nelson Mandela, who is currently battling for his life, I guess, in hospital at the moment. So there is a link to South Africa, and it feels familiar to be in a place that's undergone great political change in the last few decades as well. My subject is electrical smelting in southern Africa. And just to start off, just to locate where I'm from, I work for a company called Mintec in Randburg, part of Johannesburg in South Africa. Mintec was founded in 1934, almost 80 years ago. It is a state-owned national research institute that employs about 900 people that covers the wide, full range of metallurgical disciplines. Many of you will be familiar with this composite image by NASA of the Earth at night, and you can see why Africa is sometimes described as a dark continent. But it's good for us to remember, as we focus on technical things and trying to make this world a better place, that there remain 25% of human beings on this planet who have no access at all to electricity that we take so much for granted. But now on to the technical part of the discussion. I'm going to start with a very technical side of looking at how to classify electrical smelters, and then move on to the more socio-economic and political comments on the state of electricity in South Africa at the moment. I guess a definition wouldn't be out of place, that smelting is the metallurgical process of extracting metals from their ores by heating to extreme temperatures. And you can say that the chemical reactions are often accompanied by melting or fusion of the products, and in turn, smelting implies chemical reactions, not just simply melting the metal out of its ore. Smelting is, of course, very old. Copper has been produced in smelters since about 6,000 to 5,000 BC. Electric smelting is much newer than that, just over 100 years old by comparison. On a lighter note, electricity was described by George Carlin as really just organized lightning. Edison said that we will make electricity so cheap that only the rich will burn candles. In the software industry, people often talk about a killer application being required to popularize a new technology. And it was really Edison's popularization of the electric light bulb that was the killer application for the widespread adoption of electrical power. If it wasn't for electricity, we'd all be watching television by candlelight. Why electric smelting? We're looking during this conference at a range of smelting technologies, many of them not electrically based, and I'm not touching on those at all in this presentation. I'm looking at the particular domain where one is interested or requires very high temperatures, say greater than 1400, perhaps 1500 degrees Celsius, and much higher. The highest I've worked on personally is calcium carbide production, which requires temperatures in excess of 2,500 degrees Celsius. Electric smelting is locally a very clean approach to smelting. It produces very low volumes of gas, and it also does not contaminate slag, sometimes a valuable product, with the ash that comes from carbonaceous reductants or fuels. So the nature of the electric furnace can be described by a number of properties, and the ones that I'm going to touch on briefly are shape, type of power, number of electrodes, type of electrodes, the arc and bath characterization, and whether the furnace is open or closed, as well as a comment on the feeding arrangement. First aspect is that a furnace shape, very simply, circular or rectangular cross sections are used almost exclusively in these furnaces. The circular shape has the great advantage of minimizing the surface area per volume, which means that your energy loss from the walls of the furnace can be minimized. You can get a more intense, more efficient thermal process. But rectangular also has its place, even though it has dead zones in the corners. But binding systems are much easier to manage on a rectangular furnace. The type of power, DC or AC. DC furnaces were developed before AC furnaces, back in the late 1800s, and AC furnaces only in the early 1900s. AC power, though, became more popular because of the greater efficiency of AC distribution networks. And AC power was widely used for reasons of effective power transmission, because, of course, you can easily transform the voltage of an AC supply to a much higher voltage that requires less current to transmit over very long distances. And these central large power stations can then be used efficiently to produce electrical power, following developments by Nikola Tesla and George Westinghouse in the late 1880s. DC arc furnaces have been used for melting metals as far back as 1878, when William Siemens used the DC arc furnace with a vertical graphite cathode, with the arc transferred to the melt in contact with a water-cooled bottom anode, something that looks not too different from the more modern furnaces of today. AC furnaces were patented in 1900 by Paul Herold and operated initially in La Praz in France in 1900. The photograph shown on the left is of the first AC electric arc furnace in the United States, still currently can be seen on display in Philadelphia. There are advantages that DC has over AC, particularly in the open arc furnaces that I will describe in more detail to come. First of all, three electrodes produce three arcs, all going the same direction. They repel each other. This arc repulsion means that there's flare towards the walls of the furnace, leading to hot spots in the areas where the electrodes are closely positioned near to the sidewalls. The picture on the right shows the more even distribution that occurs with a single DC electrode. There are also advantages in terms of lower electrode consumption in DC arc furnaces. And this is really, first of all, the electrodes are smaller and there are fewer of them, and also there's higher current per electrode, alternatively expressed by saying that smaller electrodes can be used for the same current because of the AC skin effect, where the current is concentrated in the outer periphery of the electrodes for AC operation. The third aspect for this taxonomy of electrical furnaces is the number of electrodes that can be used. AC power, of course, has three phases, therefore requires three or six electrodes in three pairs. DC furnaces usually use one electrode, which makes it much easier to maintain and control, and for very high power applications, it can use two electrodes. The terminology of twin electrodes implies two cathode electrodes, whereas dual electrodes implies one cathode and one anode, two alternative ways of getting the power into the system. DC furnaces could also conceivably use three electrodes for extremely high power. This is rare, but it has been done. The type of electrodes are also very important. And principally, one has to choose between pre-baked graphite electrodes and the Soderberg electrodes that are self-baking and use inexpensive electrode paste. But of course, these can be difficult to operate. They can be difficult to bake. They can break if you don't get the baking conditions correct. And of course, you have multiple electrodes going up and down that can lead to interaction effects, again, leading to difficulties and instabilities in operation. Graphite electrodes are much simpler to manage. For the characterization of the arc and bath layouts, I'd just like to acknowledge the work of Andy Matthias of Hatch from about 20 years ago, who probably characterized these the best. A few examples. Firstly, we'll look at immersed electrode smelting, where the electrode tips are dipped in the molten slag. This is used in matte smelting and nickel laterite smelting. This requires an electrically resistive slag to generate enough energy by resistive or Joule heating. The superheated slag that's generated near to the electrode tips is usually convected outwards underneath the floating banks of feed material, and this then melts those into the bath. As long as you don't exceed a certain power intensity of the furnace, this all works well. If you go to higher intensity applications, you can have problems in that the energy that's convected to the sidewalls is greater than that that can be absorbed by the banks of feed material sitting on top of the molten slag. Open arc, open bath smelting is something that I'm going to mention a few applications of a little later on. A large fraction of the energy here is dissipated in this open electric arc. Now you can picture an open arc furnace being something like a small arc welding machine in a very large box. Alternatively, you can see it as something like a captive lightning bolt, where you have high temperature plasmas running at 10 to 20,000 degrees Celsius in this highly ionized gas-like state. The independence that is given by the open arc means that you have an extra degree of freedom in the power control of the furnace. You're no longer required and bound by the electrical properties of the molten slag that dictates how the voltage and current distribution would look. The open bath nature of the furnace means that it's able to accommodate fine feed materials directly onto the molten bath surface. Open arc operations are also useful for highly conductive slags where there isn't enough electrical resistivity to generate resistive heating, other than by going to extremely high currents, which are very expensive to operate. So if you've got an electric arc, in an open arc mode, highly conductive slags become very practical to process. However, there is a downside to this configuration, and that is that the open molten slag bath radiates significant energy to the roof and to the sidewalls of the furnace. But this can be mitigated to some degree by partially covering the molten slag bath by feed material. Submerged arc smelting really takes us to the other extreme. Now here you have a burden of solid material sitting on top of the molten slag bath and gradually melting its way downwards. The gas, the reaction gases, typically carbon monoxide being produced from the reaction of carbonaceous reductants with oxide feed materials, for example, that gas has to go somewhere, and it needs to be able to percolate through the charge. So you need to have a porous charge where there's sufficient gas permeability. Now this requires lumpy feed materials as well as coke for structural strength of this burden that can be meters high. The advantage to this, though, is that the charge is heated at the same time that the process gases are cooled, leading to greater thermal efficiency, although you have other operational challenges as the trade-off to deal with. The addition of fine feed materials is problematic to submerged arc smelting. You can imagine that the fine materials would block up the pores or the escape route for the gases, leading to eruptions or even worse, explosions. Another technique, a variation on some of these, somewhere between the open bath and the submerged arc, is something known as shielded arc smelting. This was developed by Falconbridge at the time, now Xstrata Nickel, back in the 1960s. Here, this enables you to run with longer arcs, having higher voltage, and this requires lower current operations, and the surrounding feed material absorbs energy from the arc. The next part of the classification is the furnace open or closed? Some older furnaces are open at the top. This is certainly frowned on in modern furnace design. although it's really easy to construct, it's effectively like a large bucket without a lid, into which you simply sweep the feed materials from the side. So it becomes very easy to feed a furnace of this nature. But of course, newer furnaces are closed, which is environmentally much cleaner, as well as being more energy efficient, allowing the better sealing and also the possibility of gas capture and utilization. The feeding arrangement is an interesting one, particularly for DC arc furnaces, where the early furnaces were fed through a hollow electrode. And this was really through a belief at the time that there would be in-flight reduction of the particles of ore falling through this high-temperature plasma on the way down to the molten slag bath. And because of this belief, great complexity was introduced, having to pay for expensive pre-baked graphite electrodes, paying somebody to drill out and remove a portion of the electrode, and then have the added complexity of having to insert a feed tube down the electrode, which also introduced the possibility of blockages, as well as needing to be removed every time you added a new electrode section. Interestingly, this turns out to be one of the myths of DC arc smelting, is that you have to feed through a hollow electrode. In fact, feeding can be done close to the arc attachment zone where the plasma arc makes its way from the tip of the electrode to the molten slag bath, which is a very violent, very turbulent, very intense processing zone. The formation of banks of unreacted charge material can be promoted by feeding near to the furnace walls as an alternative. And of course, then there are many other aspects that I'm not going to try and concentrate on here in a short half an hour lecture. These other aspects could include roof design, the hearth design, the design of the tap holes where the slag and metal is removed from the furnace, as well as cooling systems where copper fingers or plates or waffles can be introduced onto the furnace. Many different techniques exist for off-gas handling, etc. So an overall summary of all of the aspects that we've covered can be presented pictorially with this classification system. And I think any of the examples that we're going to touch on, we could highlight one category in each of these sections where it would be applicable. So the first example I'd like to touch on is the 6-in-line furnace used in PGM smelting. 6 electrodes in line have been used for PGM smelting since 1969. The first furnace was about 20 MVA, about 27 meters long, 8 meters wide, and 6 meters high, just to give you some idea of the size and shape of this furnace. So if we look at the classification system in red, I've highlighted the particular ones that would be relevant here. So we have a rectangular AC 6-electrode using Söderberg electrodes of about a meter and a half in diameter with an immersed electrode where the electrode is dipped into the molten slag. It's a closed furnace with feeding around the electrodes, so many different feed ports around the 6 electrodes that are used. Perhaps the best example of this particular type of furnace in southern Africa would be that of Anglo-American Platinum's Polokwane furnace in the north of the country that has a capacity of 650,000 tons per annum of feed material, about 87 tons per hour. This runs at a power of 68 megawatts, although if you look at the MVA rating of the furnace, you can see it allows for quite a wide range of voltage and current. It runs under reasonably intense power conditions at 250 kilowatts per square meter. Nowhere near that area possible in the DC circular furnaces, but nevertheless much higher than previous applications for platinum group metals. The matte or molten sulfide, base metal sulfides, temperature is about 1550 degrees Celsius and slag temperature of 1600 degrees. In the second example, I'm going to talk about a DC arc furnace used for the production of ferrochrome from chromite fine ores. Now here I'm going to put into words that classification scheme. We have a circular DC furnace with one graphite electrode running in open arc, open bath mode in a closed vessel with feed distributed around the electrode. Here you can see an image of the rapidly moving electrical arc making contact onto the slag, and you can see the splashing and stirring that makes this a very intense reaction zone where materials can be assimilated into that feed and reactions can happen very rapidly indeed. So just as a reflection in symbolic terms of the verbal description I've just given you for the DC arc furnace, I have no need to repeat what I've just said. The schematic view of the furnace is shown here with a single central graphite electrode with the open arc impinging on the molten slag bath overlying the molten metal, which is in contact then with one or other type of anode design at the base of the furnace. In this particular case, the problem essentially is that one needs to devise, or needed to devise, a process to treat fine chromite ores. In the Southern African Transvaal chromites, so-called, they have a great degree of friability, and so there are large stockpiles of very fine ore materials. So the DC furnace operates with an open arc, open bath configuration. Now this is important in that it allows you to treat fine materials directly, but also economically very important is that you don't need to use coke. Coke is very expensive, environmentally very costly, and this removes the need for coke usage completely. Power supplied to the furnace is independent of the slag composition because of the open electric arc. So slag can be changed by the addition of various fluxes to allow the activities of the chrome in that molten system to change favorably so that you can achieve much higher degrees of chromium recovery. A typical comparison between an AC submerged arc furnace and a DC open arc furnace would be you get about going from 85% to 95% chromium recovery, a significant advantage. The DC furnace also has a lower electrode consumption. So again, it's really all about finding the right type of furnace for the particular problem that one is trying to solve. A little bit of history. Mintek investigated this problem in 1976 as a means of solving the problem of chromite fines, which at that point couldn't be utilized in submerged arc furnaces. The first bench scale production was in 1979, and the 1 ton an hour pilot plant was commissioned in 1984. At the same time that the technology was commercialized at a plant called Palmit Ferrochrome, located in Krugersdorp, 1 hour away from Johannesburg, where initially a 12 megawatt furnace was built and later upgraded to 40 MVA, or about 30 megawatts, in 1988. Later, an additional 10 megawatt furnace was built on the same site for Mahali Alloys. Within the same group, the Samancor Chrome Company built a 44 megawatt furnace in 1997. And again, about another 12 years later, built a 60 megawatt furnace. And the 60 megawatt furnace, together with the 40 megawatt that's now been also upgraded to 60 megawatt, this is currently the largest DC arc furnace for ferrochrome production. However, this is about to be superseded as another 472 megawatt furnaces are under construction by SMS CMAG in Kazakhstan. I visited them a week and a half ago, and very impressive to see them going up at this stage. The third example is here mentioned because it allows the same DC arc furnace equipment to be used for very different reasons. In the case of ferrochrome or chromite smelting, we've seen that the reason there is to allow fines feeding into the furnace directly and to avoid the requirement for coke. But in the case of ilmenite smelting for the production of titanium slag and pig iron, we have a very different problem. The titanium slag, or TiO2 slag, is highly conductive, and therefore there's not enough resistance in the slag bath to give you sufficient heating that's required by the process. So you need to have an open arc. Historically, this has been done in 6-in-line open arc AC furnaces, but that technology was locked up and an alternative needed to be found. Furthermore, the slag is a valuable product and contamination must be avoided. So again, rather trying to use an open arc rather than having any touching of the electrodes with the slag. Also, the degree of reduction must be very carefully controlled. Therefore, no electrode immersion is possible. So this particular process was piloted at Mintec in 1990 and commercialized at Namakwa Sands, not too far away from Cape Town, in 1994 with a 25 megawatt furnace, followed 4 years later by a 35 megawatt furnace. Two further 36 megawatt furnaces, based on the success, were built then at Taikor near Mbangeni and commissioned in 2003. And a further application of this technology was a 30 megawatt furnace commissioned for CYMG in China in 2009. Now, the final few moments of my presentation, I'd like to talk more broadly about the problem of electricity in South Africa. So just going back a little in history, South Africa has a very plentiful coal supply. So for better or for worse, coal is really the principal technology used for power generation in South Africa. Many large coal-fired power stations were built from the 1960s to the 1980s. Back then, an excess of capacity with a reserve margin of 55% applied. Power was plentiful and cheap. And there was a need in South Africa to beneficiate minerals. So this became a very large user of this cheap power. South Africa currently has about 40 gigawatts of power-generating capacity. And the mining industry uses about 15% of that capacity, with about two-thirds of that being used directly by smelting. So about 2 gigawatts are used for ferroalloy furnaces, 0.4 gigawatts for ilmenite, 0.3 gigawatts for platinum, and 1.5 gigawatts for aluminium, although technically, by my definition, these aren't strictly speaking smelters. Now, one of the major successes that's not often widely recognized. In South Africa, the democratic government came into power in 1994. At that time, only 36% of South African households had access to electricity. By 2011, when this was measured in a national survey, 83% of South African households had access to electricity. Certainly a major accomplishment in a very short space of time. However, not only successes apply, there's also a major failure that where the finger can be pointed at the failure of government policy. The government wanted regional electricity distribution in addition to the national Eskom supplier, but the electricity price was too low, so no incentive existed to invest in power stations, so no outside foreign investment took place. And of course, power stations take a very long time to build, and if you lose that momentum, it takes a very long time to catch it up. So for a period, there was insufficient capital investment, and electricity demand grew faster than supply. So this led to the load shedding crisis in 2008, where whole areas of towns had power switched off for about 4 hours at a time. Furthermore, electricity prices tripled in the past 6 years, to provide for new capacity that has to be built. This involves an increase of about 25% a year on average over the past 6 years. This is a major change to the industry. New power stations are now being built. The new Medupi and Kusile coal-fired power stations will total almost 10 gigawatts. These are the first baseload power plants to be built in South Africa in 20 years. The new Medupi power station of about 5 gigawatts should be operational next year, ramping up to full power by 2016 at a cost of 100 billion rand, which is about 7.5 billion euros. The Kusile power station, essentially a carbon copy of the Medupi power station, should follow about a year later. Here's a photograph of the Medupi power station, currently in an advanced stage of construction. This has had a marked effect on the ferrochrome industry in South Africa. This has been constrained by lack of power. And this has really prevented South Africa from benefiting from the minerals boom of the past decade that was driven primarily by the urbanization of China. Of the world's top 10 mining countries, South Africa was the only one over a 10-year period that actually showed a decline, not an increase, over this boom period. Many ferroalloy smelters are currently shut, and some are actually paid by Eskom to not use electricity in order to make it available to others in the lead up to the new capacity being available and to prevent load shedding happening again. So much South African chromite ore is now being sold to China to make ferrochrome, in turn to make stainless steel. News reports said that China overtook South Africa as the world's leading ferrochrome producer in 2012. Really an absurd situation. So in conclusion, electric smelting continues to have a large part to play in the South African economy, but challenges remain with regard to the supply of electricity over the next few years. Electricity prices are increasing rapidly, and smelting processes will have to increase their energy efficiencies. Thank you.